On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it is WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen with us once again, the author of Work's New Age and Choosing a Lasting Career for Work's New Age, and more importantly and more contemporary, the Work's New Age blog spot, which is updated a couple of times a week sometimes. We have Dr. James B. Huntington.
Good morning, Doug. Good morning, listeners.
And the doctor is back from Hong Kong, so we'll talk about that a little bit later. But we always start with the AJSN, and the AJSN means what?
The American Job Shortage Number, which tells us how many more jobs, in addition to those that are already advertised or out there, could be quickly filled if everyone knew that getting one would be just going out and getting it and stopping at the grocery store and coming back home sort of thing. If everyone knew they would be easy and routine to get, how many positions could we, in theory, fill based on people who are not working?
Well, looking at what you have written for this month, it seems like it's a mixed bag, right?
Yes. Well, it started out very weak because the number of new jobs, the net new positions that came out in the report, actually total non-farm payroll employment is what they say there, that wound up losing 23,000 over the previous month when other estimates that were gaining between 80,000 and 95,000. However, the other measures were more even, and ultimately nothing really happened. Nothing changed in the jobs report. It was not really a loser, but it wasn't a winner either.
Yeah, the labor force participation rate and the employment population ratio, not that much of a change.
Well, they dropped a tenth of a percent, which does mean something for those. Those are among the worst. And the number of people working part-time for economic reasons, that's something which the Bureau of Labor Statistics tracks. It's completely in addition to unemployment or anything like that. It's people who are working less than full-time but looking for full-time positions and not yet finding them. That went up 100,000. There are 4.8 million. In a way, it's discouraging to see it going up. It's been really on the rise for the last year or so, most of the time. So that was where more jobs could have helped.
And it says that the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate fell a tenth of a percent, but you do not do seasonably adjusted for AJSN, right?
Right. The AJSN is not seasonally adjusted. So it went down. It went down a little bit. It was interesting that it went down, but what that means is if it's a poor month for jobs and a good month for the unemployment rate, that generally means people left the labor force, and that's what happened.
On your last paragraph here, it says, what happened? Nothing. The number of people not interested in work rose 284,000, which explains the lower unemployment rate. Otherwise, it looks light and variable, no trends, no big areas of concern, and no real changes. Likewise, no progress. And the metaphorical turtle that you use every month, the turtle stayed right where he was.
So it was really a nothing month. If we wanted it to improve, we could be disappointed, and so I think we could be disappointed, but there are too many people out there who will say, oh, we lost jobs, that means it was an automatic real stinker of a month. No, we've had months where we gained 50,000 jobs that were worse overall than this one. And the other things were just hidden in other numbers and other results.
We've had months that we've gained 50,000 and it's worse. How is that again?
Yes, exactly. Because the other numbers, the ones we talked about and a few others were considerably worse, where we really should have gained more than that. And unemployment may have gone up instead of down, and these other things could have been much worse or considerably worse than they were before.
And I'll just say that in a case like that, watch the media this month, because I'm sure the partisans who have no great love for Trump will sit there and say, well, this is a terrible month. This is all his fault. Whereas if it would have been Biden or Obama, it would have been, well, this is an even month, nothing gained, nothing lost. And again, I blame the messenger more than I will blame what actually happened here or any politician.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it really was not a great month. It was an off month, but it fits in one of the two or three worst months of the year, more or less. It's hardly catastrophic. We've had some months that really were, but that's... But the idea is that when we key on one or two numbers here, and at times in the past, the unemployment rate, the adjusted unemployment rate has had that role. So people would lead with that and then really just say more or less act as if it was a good month automatically.
Yeah.
And it did that here, but this was really a no gain, no nothing month. And that's what we should be thinking of it as.
Yeah. So you can say it's spinning your wheels or whatever. At least it didn't get worse. It didn't get better. It just was. And again, the thing when I mentioned Trump, some people are going to say, oh, well, you know, you're being a Trumper on this. It's like, you know, it's the fact of the matter. If you have a D after whoever is in the president's name, the media tends to spin any economic news as being good or not important. And if there's an R there, unless it's the, you know, I'm sure that there are people that were blaming Reagan for having too much growth at one point or another during the 80s. But media tends to do what will get the most clicks. And that's something I don't like about my chosen profession. But it's the way it is.
And I think we'd find that every president really has had good months, bad months, and indifferent months.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of the president, so he's still been doing tariff bingo. Have you seen any real effect to that, where it's helping anybody?
Things keep changing so often, they aren't sustained enough to really see what the effect is. If we went with the same ones, if they were unchanged for 6 months or so, we'd see some real patterns. But it's like we have people making small adjustments or whatever, and then we have people, employers or companies rather, absorbing the tariffs. And we have results that are ambiguous, and we have not had the kind of thing where we've had sudden improvements or sudden worsenings based on the tariff situation. That just has not materialized at all. So it's very hard to say. I just have to go with the common sense idea that when you're raising prices, in effect raising what customers have to pay, it's going to be bad for sales. It's really exactly how much, no, but I don't think there's anybody alive or any government database that can tell us just how much in tariffs there have been for any given month or whatever. Even the amounts collected don't really match up with the tariffs because they're not all paid.
Yeah, that's the other thing about it. If you were now, some people are going to say, well, you have to understand what Trump is doing is using the tariffs as a club. He's not using it to necessarily affect an economic change in the traditional sense. He's using it to punish people, saying, okay, you're going to do this, I'm going to do that. You stop doing this, I'll pull the tariff. And he's done that back and forth. How long does it usually take a tariff to have any positive or negative effect? Because it's not going to happen overnight, is it?
Probably it would be months.
Yeah.
Several months, depending on how much it is and, you know, what people are expecting as far as whether it'll come or go. And it's all very hard to read. And they have changed so much that in my blog, in my general way of thinking, I haven't really wanted to trade much on them or think much about them.
And again, not a fan of tariffs because you say, oh, China's going to pay the tariff. No, the American consumer will if you buy something that was made in China.
That's exactly right, and that's exactly the problem.
Now you say, well, you just buy something that's made in America. Okay, well, if that item is made in America, and it may cost a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Mike Rowe Jobs Works, the whole thing, you know, dirty jobs and all that. He has a great foundation. He has been a long-time advocate for people working with their hands as opposed to, okay, you just go to college, go into debt for the rest of your life, and get a white-collar job. That's not what society needs only. You need that, but you also need the blue-collar worker. And he did some type of premium that he was giving away for donations to his charity. And somebody said, hey, I thought you said these were going to be made in America. It's like, okay, we're selling them for $50 as it is, with some of the money going to the, you know, the majority of the money going to the jobs program. We checked and tried to get it made in America. It would have cost $150 just to get it made the way we were making them overseas. So if you read the whole information, he had that in the disclaimer, but a lot of people said, well, you talk about American jobs. He says, no, I talk about jobs. I talk about the economy. But, you know, that's the truth of things right now, unfortunately. I'm not going to name the manufacturer, but there was a particular brand of shirt I used to get, and they went overseas back in the 70s. And the cost of the shirt has remained relatively stable, although the average one, I mean, back in the 70s, you get for $12, and you're not going to get that anymore for a short sleeve shirt or something. But they started doing ones made in America. The same shirt made in America, they wanted $150 for that shirt, and some of them were $210 for a short sleeve shirt. And you look at the one on the next rack that was made overseas by the same company, and it would be $23, which is the average consumer going to buy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I like it. It's just, it is what it is, right?
Yes, that's really all.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, Dr. James B. Huntington. We talk with him about jobs, the economy, and AI, but we're going to talk about Hong Kong because you were just there. Why did you go?
Well, it's one of my favorite places. It's on my short list of 5 destinations in the world, and this was my 8th trip there. I haven't been there for 8 years, actually. There were demonstrations which caused problems with people going there, and then COVID hit, and then I just had other things and other plans since then. But this was the first time I'd seen it in a long time, from by my standards, but it is an amazing place in many different ways, really.
Well, that the first time you saw it, it would have been under its own rule as opposed to Chinese rule. In other words, the UK, et cetera, et cetera. And now, of course, it's had quote-unquote independent rule, which is really China. And they've managed to, shall we say, stick their fingers into the pie on more than a few occasions. What do you see different from the first time you were there to this time?
Well, mainly it's all positive things as far as the effect of the Chinese government and the crackdown and less free speech and such things. That has not really affected anything much. It's still Hong Kong. It still makes the same stunning impression when you go there, and it's still changing. It's always evolving, changing, getting more and more, in a way, more and more into the future, but you can call that really more modern. It's, in a way, it's more like New York City than New York City is. The expression I've used, actually, I coined this within hours of my getting there from the first time, but I've used it many times since, and it's like if New York is too slow-paced, not cosmopolitan enough, and doesn't have anywhere near enough shopping, then Hong Kong is for you.
Now, you know there are going to be New Yorkers that say, them's fighting words. Actually, they'd say it in some other way that we can't use on the radio, but how do you mean that? Is it just one open-air market, or It's just, I know it's an economic engine, and it's got to be helping as far as the Chinese government, that they're getting some of that largesse now, where in past maybe they weren't.
Well, they were before. They were always getting taxes and such things, where there's so much money and so much business. The intensity of business, really, there are certainly areas of New York City that can compete with that, but Hong Kong is even more compressed. They have about 7.5 million people in their 400 square miles, and that includes some rural, really, sections and mountains and things where very few live. It's just, it's, there's so many there. It has a very, very high business emphasis. It's, there's so much business going on there, especially small businesses, where that has translated really into prosperity for that. The especially retail, a real emphasis on selling things. They've been a duty-free port for a long time. They've had low taxes, and that's helped them a lot, tremendously. Again, more prosperity from all that sort of thing. Even when the rents, even when rents are high, and they are very high in some places there, high volume can help. That's a lot like New York City, where you'd wonder why anyone could pay the rents, but then you realize how much in sales. One thing you'll notice right away, and my girlfriend noticed that, she'd never been there before, and she said she noticed how packed the stores are. They have so much stuff in them. They go way up to the ceiling, and they use grabber things to bring down something if somebody wants them. They're just absolutely full of stuff there, and they seem to sell more and more that way.
Well, my understanding has always been that that space is at a premium in the city.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. But there are so many businesses. There are so many people having a go at it. They work very hard culturally and long hours. There are all kinds of people there who are willing, when they're younger, to work extra long, I don't know, 70, 80, and 90 hours a week, sometimes even, to set themselves up for later on. And they're really quite rich by the time they get to middle age or so, if they're able to keep doing that.
Well, and, is that the business owner, or is that the worker, the average worker, who's going to be quite
both.
Rich?
Both. Yeah, I mean, even the workers. The workers will, they're ambitious. They will plan on working long hours and then starting their own businesses and moving on from there. And they're, I don't know what the total value of merchandise there is. Just, I wish I knew some more numbers about these things, but they really are huge. And you go down streets where it's just one store after another, and they're competing with each other, and prices are relatively low because they couldn't stay in business if other places had them beat. And they have so much for sale, and the hours, really the general hours for stores and such, are about 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. It's the kind of place you can go late at night and find a lot of places open. And other kinds of businesses, of course, do their thing, but it has some staggering places where there was one building. There is a famous, actually, it's a cluster of buildings that goes by one name. It's Chongqing Mansions. It's on the most expensive area there, which they call the Golden Mile, because rents are so high and there are so many tourists, where they have incredible amounts. They have had incredible amounts of business going on in that building. It's like, it's about 12, 15-story buildings tied next to each other. And if you take an elevator up to a middle or high floor, you have to make sure it's the right elevator, because they don't all reach to the entire upper floor, so they're really sort of separate buildings. But they have literally dozens of hotels, and it's filled with shops on the ground level. Two levels below that is a shopping mall. Levels above that, you have businesses that are a little more casual, but still really going, things like barbershops, offices of importers. It has such a history that at one point, the continent of Africa, which was a little poorer then than it is now, and the cell phones they bought were generally reconditioned older models, and at one point something like half of the cell phones that went to Africa passed through Chongqing mansions. They'd get thousands or tens of thousands of them and refurbish them and do the work there, and people would come over from Africa and buy 1,000 or 10,000 cell phones for resale, and right, just all in that same building where somebody counted over 100 nationalities living or working in that building. And it's the most diverse place, really has been the most diverse place in the world, where almost any language or hundreds of languages get spoken.
More diverse than New York City, you'd say?
Yes, definitely. They have. New York City is close, and it has some great things like Rastafarian neighborhoods. Brooklyn, in particular, is close, but there are areas in Hong Kong that are closer to, especially Africa and the subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, those places. There are lots and lots of people. They go there to seek their fortune. And one way they have been helped is that there are laws. The laws are not as extreme as far as what employees can do and so on. That has helped them a lot in the past. It's just sort of the ideal climate for business in a way.
Now, I'm asking this as an outsider, because somebody who is going to be criticizing the American way of business is going to say, well, the little guy in America, if you don't pay off to the big guys, if you don't have an in with somebody, if you don't know somebody, you're not going to be allowed to compete in real time. Of course, that's not really true. You will have to deal with bureaucracy. You'll have to deal with a ton of regulations depending upon where you are. Far worse in California than, say, it would be in Pennsylvania. But when these people who are trying to do all these businesses, do they have the freedom to operate, or is it all, government may I before you do anything?
They have great freedom. They have great freedom to operate, and that's helped them massively.
Now, do they have any political freedom? Because one of the things about the protests years ago, they were saying, hey, we don't like this idea where you can simply take somebody out of Hong Kong, bring them into mainland China, and deal with the laws there, which are Byzantine at best. And they eventually stopped most of the protests simply by cracking down and arresting so many people that it snuffed it out.
Well, I think they're more concerned about what people were saying. Like, at previous visits to Hong Kong, I saw demonstrations against the Chinese government and such. I don't think you could do that now. I didn't see anything like that, not that I always would have. But the business, the whole business and prosperity side seems to be going as well as anything.
I remember, I think it was CNN, there were the protesters in the before the crackdown were waving American flags and saying, we want, human rights, etc. Mm-hmm. And there were commentators on CNN saying, boy, these guys are stupid. Why are they waving American flags? Because they see us as more freedom than what they have, or they feel their freedom is threatened compared to what we have.
Well, we don't have a communist overlord, and that means something. But it seems like the business side of Hong Kong is very much there. It may not last forever, because at times the Chinese government has tried to move a lot of things to Shenzhen, which is a city that sprouted up like a mushroom and is now something like 10 million people and actually borders Hong Kong. But I don't know. A lot of people do so much business there, and it works for them, so I'm not sure that's going to be so easy.
Would you say that that second city is more or less their attempt to clone Hong Kong, but under their more iron control?
It might be. It might very possibly be. That's a good thought, and they might like to do that. But then again, they have to be very leery of harassing Hong Kong too much because it generates so much money. And if there are enough gray area things that you can buy about anything, really anything, in Hong Kong. And that has to be allowed to continue because I don't even know what the taxes are. Even if the rates are low, the total amounts are so high, they're paying so much. And it's been different as far as getting into it. Americans need a visa to go to regular China, but not to go to Hong Kong.
Really?
And so you can really just, it's the same thing.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, Dr. James B. Huntington, talking jobs, the economy, and AI, and right now talking Hong Kong, just for a little bit longer since he just got back from there. As an American, did you feel safe there? And what was the attitude most of the time toward you? Or it's just like, you got money, we'll be your friends.
It's very safe. The rates of street crime, for some reason, in the far eastern countries are very low. One thing is they are more serious about videotaping things in public areas. If you're on an underpass below a road or something, you might see a little sign that says CCTV. And that just reminds people that they may think they're alone, but they're really not quite. And the way the legal system has worked in China, if you're caught on video doing something, I mean, there's almost no need for a trial. You're guilty. They don't have the same intensity back and forth and needing to do all that.
I have to wonder.
Also, it's just the culture, something about the culture. They just don't do that. There's just very little tendency to do that.
Well, part of it I would figure is cultural, but the other part I figure is if the government is going to crack down on you for doing something illegal, you're not going to do that if they actually enforce it. Here, it's like, oh, well, you know, he shot 10 people, but you know, we let him out on bail because we got too many people in jail right now. I don't think you're ever going to read that story in Hong Kong.
No, and it's just something there. Another thing is there are so many people around in general in public. I would be harder, even without the closed-circuit TV cameras, it would be harder to find an opportunity to do something like that.
Well, do you think that the average Hong Kong citizen would laugh at Americans' anxiety over flock cameras?
Probably. They'd wonder what all the fuss is about. I mean, if that kind of thing protects people, they would say, why not have them?
Yeah, and there was the woman who last week was pulled over twice at gunpoint by cops because her car was listed as stolen. It was not. But hey, you know, mistakes happen. Tell that to the person who has the guns pointed at them twice for no good reason. That's more Geico, garbage in, garbage out. You have to have some human responsibility as well. Well, speaking of that, getting back to AI just a second here, I wanted to get your take on the story where one of the AI companies said, we better let you know about this now, but one of our AIs got loose. It's not one of our AIs is missing. It's one of our AIs got loose, and they started compiling information and hacking into one of our competitors. So we figured we'd let you know. What's your take on that?
I think maybe they're trying to be honest. Maybe they didn't really know what they were doing when this happened. This is a story that came out. They said, we had a significant security incident during evaluation of our models where apparently it intruded into a competitor's system. You do wonder, it's hard to say what happened. It could have been deliberate. It could have not been. So we'll see what kind of thing happens from here on out with these.
Well, I do remember years ago there was somebody who had been a disgruntled Coca-Cola employee that went to Pepsi and said, hey, I've got some inside information. And the first thing the Pepsi executives did was go, uh-huh, wait here a second, called the cops, called Coca-Cola and said, come get your guy and prosecute him. So they weren't about to get involved in espionage like that. They had what they believed was their fairness in it, and you'd like to think it would be the same way as a reciprocal. But in something like this, that could be, hey, don't prosecute us. We're tattling on ourselves. Or something else I read online, somebody commenting on one of the stories said, you know, they could be doing this to say, look how good our AI is. Hey, you think that'll help our stock price?
And there is a lot of that going on. That's been the real reason I've suspected and a lot of other people have suspected that they will say we're eliminating 1,000 jobs because our AI is so good, and that's really not the reason. And the competitors get all scared and said, oh, ours has bugs all over the place, and it's not reliable, and they must be doing much better than us. At least they're trying. They seem to be trying to get a reaction like that when that's not the reason for them cutting jobs at all.
I don't know. It strikes me that people seem ready to say, well, you know, nobody will be held accountable for AI. And like I said before, garbage in, garbage out. Somebody is coding these things. Somebody owns them. If I have a car that causes damage to somebody, even if I'm not driving it, I'm probably liable on some level for it. Unless somebody steals it and I have no, you know, I have not given them permission to have it and they just steal it out of my driveway and decide to mow somebody down that they don't like, I'm not going to be held liable for that. But if I loan it to somebody or an employee of mine is using one of my work vehicles and does something, you're going to have some liability to that company. And I'm thinking these AI organizations, they're getting off easy in people's minds. Like, oh, well, you know, we just don't know what they're going to do. Well, yeah, but the people that are releasing them are responsible, are they not?
Yes. Well, a lot of that has not been worked out very well yet. The laws are not solid. They're not in place. But I think obviously we're going to have programmers or companies or somebody is going to be responsible for these things. I think it will probably go to the companies that release them and such instead of going after employees. That kind of thing usually doesn't happen, but there will be. But a lot of it is still a gray area and unknown. So it may be, why? If there was some culpability from the company on this incident, that it would be better to do that now than maybe in a couple years when the laws may be all nailed down and not in their favor.
Well, one of your articles here we wanted to get to, artificial intelligence-driven robots, moving right along, literally. One of the things you talk about, AI robot changes your tires and balances them. And I'm thinking, well, you know, my dad was a mechanic, and I'm thinking you may have a lot of robots that can build cars, but they can't take care of them. And now they're sitting here saying, oh, we can, or at least do this much.
Well, this was an impressive bunch of robot stories that I got here. They were only over 2 months, really, and there were 10 of them. And they were doing a variety of things. Sometimes it was a little hard to tell whether the thing was actually commercially available yet, but in several cases they were. And yes, I mean, this was one thing here, Smart Bay, and an AI-powered robotic tire change platform for dealerships, tire shops, and service centers. And they could handle tire changes. They could change tires. They could balance wheels and so on. Do vehicle inspections, most of the things there. That's, we have them here in New York, and that's would be a very good thing, really, if they would have something like that. Then there were the other nine things.
Yeah, well, just before you go, would you be comfortable with that, doing the balancing of the tires on your car, as opposed to having
sure.
a human being do it? You'd be okay with
it? I would expect that if they were to put that into commercial service, that if they were to do that and they would be charging me money to do that, I would expect that they would have everything all set, that everything would be good. It's possible there would be more chance of an error, but I've had them. You get errors at places like that at mechanics anyway. I mean, one time I had some small amount of work done on my car and drove away, and after, I don't know, 500 feet or something away, it just died. And it turned out somebody had put a clip on the gas line.
Oh, well,
and so people will do that, those things. But really, if they're charging money for it, then they know that they're completely liable for anything going wrong. So I have to go with their judgment. If I trust the place in general, I'll trust it specifically on that.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, AI makes what's called hallucinations, so it may think it's done what it said it was going to do, and you go out and your tires are going to last 1,000 miles because they're totally messed up.
Well, then that place made a judgment error in putting this into service and allowing it to do it for me. If they have tendencies of doing that sort of thing, and I don't see much of any reports on robots having hallucinations and
but if it's
things.
Backed with AI, it's just AI
if it's backed
is,
with AI, it could be. It could be. I just don't see that as being a real problem, that they can test these things and see, and if it does it once every 10,000 times or something like that, well, they'd be liable and they'd compensate you for damage or whatever.
WRTA Weekend, Doug Herendeen with us, Dr. James B. Huntington. His Works New Age blogspot is available online. We'll have a link to that on the podcast page of this program, as it'll be up on WRTA.com in just a few. We're talking with artificial intelligence-driven robots moving right along, literally. And one of them here is a rideable robot looks to stomp all over us. And this is from which news organization, I'm sure, but it says, this is from Unitree. It costs $574,000. It can carry a passenger, smash bricks, and shift to a four-legged form. It looks like a real-life GoBot. Most likely use seems to be entertainment, exhibitions, research, security demos, and specialized industrial testing. You could probably buy one now if you want to for $574,000. Really?
You know, it's just like a giant toy is what it is. They seemed clear, at least, the columnist. And the stories in this article were all from some branch of Fox Business or Fox News.
Oh, okay.
Because they have a staffer who writes consistently on these and other things, and they're the best source for such things. And this one, I mean, he was sort of saying it didn't have a practical use that was worth anything much, consistent with what it was costing.
Sure, it burns money. And I know, look, there are some people that got money to burn, and, $574,000 for a toy, yes, it'll amuse me. If it can smash bricks,
yes.
I don't know that I want it amusing me, but this next one is more interesting to me. AI robotic beehive installed in Florida community claims a 70% reduction in colony collapse threatening crops. They're called Bee Home Systems. And they're made by BeeWise. They use the product now in use by Land O'Lakes uses robotics, sensors, artificial intelligence to monitor the hive health and protect colonies from environmental threats. And arrives as bee populations across the United States continue facing pressures from parasites, pesticides, disease, and extreme weather conditions. For those who are not in the know, and we've talked about this on a different program with horticulture educator Tom Butzler from Penn State Cooperative Extension, colony collapse disorder has been going on for years now. And thankfully, we still have bees because if you don't have pollinators, you don't have crops, and then you don't eat. So it's a really good idea that we find out what's killing off so many of the hives. And I'm interested to know how this thing exactly manages the conditions for the beehives.
Yes, well, I don't know. But it seems to be well developed and does quite well. And perhaps if there were threats that it could not handle, it would notify the owner. But it seems like an effort to create an automated beehive.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen them. I understand how they work. But I'm trying to figure out how the AI works because I'm a little suspicious of the 70% reduction in colony collapse threatening crops. Because, again, and let's understand how big agribusiness is in Pennsylvania. This would be very important if we could have something like this here. But the 70% figure is what's stumping me as to exactly how they're doing it. It's from a story by Brittany Miller of Fox News, May 21st, and you can look at that, and you can also look at it on Dr. Huntington's deal there. But I'm thinking I want that to be true, but it sounds to me like a bit of puffery. What's your take?
Well, it could be. It could very well be. There's certainly been a lot of puffery in AI marketing, but that is what the company claims. And beyond that, I don't have any technical knowledge. I can't really say whether that's realistic or not. If it could be perfectly legitimate and revolutionary, or it could be overstated.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. I'm hoping this is 100% true, and I'm going to have to get some more information on this, and we'll talk with Tom Butzler on a different program sometime in the future on this. An improvement in an area getting automation attention for not only years, but for decades. Humanoid robots work nonstop in package test. This is also from Fox News. This time, three of them made by Figure AI and using its in-house AI system without human control cross more than 24 hours of continuous autonomous operation after a test that was supposed to last only 8 hours but kept running. So if robots can work right through long shifts, what happens to people who do this work today? Although businesses want to know how often robots fail, how much maintenance they need, and whether they can handle messy conditions without slowing down the whole operation, if companies can make these robots reliable, safe, and affordable, the warehouse floor could look very different in years ahead. I notice how many people scream about Amazon and their warehouses, especially out in Metro New York where I was just the other week with my friends. But I also noticed that every time they offer employment, thousands of people show up for hundreds of jobs. And if they could, I'm thinking of anything, if they've got a system where, okay, this item is in slot A17 and this one is in slot Z27, the robot's going to be faster at zipping around to get that. You just have to keep them from running into each other as opposed to having a human do that.
Well, they've been trying for a long time to get robotic warehouse workers, and they've made already a lot of progress, but they've always had so far things where the robot has to stop and the person has to hand something over to another robot or whatever, and it seems like they're claiming that they're getting past that. And there is another story in here related to that. Things like taking packages out of trailers and handing them off to something else. So then this other one, they the handoff ability, the ability to hand things off, is still generally left to humans. But if they can get robots to do it, as the author of this piece said, the capability may turn out to make the difference, really, between worthwhile and doubtful automation. That's my paraphrase, but it's essentially what he was saying.
I've known people that work for UPS, and some of the conditions I've heard about are not exactly ideal. The amount of traffic and packages that they carry are legion. And I have to wonder if they actually think someday they're just going to have robots replace us. First off, if you attack a guy carrying a package, he may be able to fend you off. But I've seen some of these things where people break into manned trucks and just steal everything out of it. You have automated systems that go out there and do this. Like, oh, I'd like to deliver this package to your neighbor. Yeah, well, I'm going to take it. What are you going to do about it? I got a baseball bat. Wham! Here's my package. Thank you so much. Now, if you catch the guy doing it with the flock camera or the camera on the thing, that's fine. But I get the feeling that, you know, we're not quite ready for that. And also a lot of people who do these jobs now aren't quite ready to be replaced.
Well, one thing, freight theft has gone up a lot in recent years, and it may have something to do with the level of automation and the lack of human beings around the area. And as far as the workers, yes, it's been a news story how much money UPS package deliverers can make, that with overtime, they can make over $200,000 a year.
Yes, but I've talked to some of them who have, for the working conditions they have to put up with and the idiocy of, they were, at least in this one shop, they were trying to fire everybody. It's like, They didn't care how many people they had to hire, because there was always a line out the door to take the job. But especially if you've been there a while and were making more, they were looking to trip you up and just kick you out the door. And one guy I talked to, he'd been like under threat of dismissal 7 times at this point. I says, why do you stay? He says, because they pay so much. Is it worth defending what you're doing? Yeah, because they're lying about what they're doing to us. Now, that was his story. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And a robot certainly is not going to complain, but then again, can the robot think and do as much as a human being?
And shall we say they're getting closer? I can't really judge from these articles, a lot of them which are driven by what companies are saying, but we may even be within a few years of getting everything short of driving, and that's its own thing, which is on the way, that they may be virtually automated away by 2030 even.
Artificial intelligence-driven robots moving right along, literally, is the article. There's a couple other that we'll post links to as well on the podcast. Dr. James B. Huntington, thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you, listeners.